Our very first talk is Martin DeHoop from the Colorado School of Mines.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. I think this is a wonderful opportunity to meet many old friends and make some new friends, and also have an opportunity to give an overview of work we started pretty much a decade ago on using microlocal analysis in the seismic imaging inversion and tomography problems. And that is pretty much what I will talk about. Now, really what I will do is, there will be three key pieces in the talk. I will review some early work that we did in the early 90s on imaging inversion in elastic media from seismic data. And that is pretty much based on single scattering theory, Born-Kirchhoff theory. Then I'll make a quick remark how much more recently we got some insight in local uniqueness issues of the inverse problem, not global, only local. And then I'll move into the problem of tomography, namely, can we reconstruct smooth media, or what seismologists say, can we do velocity analysis with microlocal techniques also? And that is really largely our current work. Now, when we do a seismic experiment, by the way, my intention is, since I understand there are both mathematicians and geophysicists here, that I kind of do a mix of mathematical and geophysical terminology and even have pictures that will try to glue the two together. So maybe I hope both parties will kind of understand the link, at least the people that are not familiar with it. Now, what is the idea in a seismic experiment? We have sources and receivers at the Earth's surface or at the ocean bottom, and we try to reconstruct the elastic medium properties. This is governed by the elastic wave equation. And what do we mean by microlocal techniques? Well, we base our analysis on the wavefront set, abbreviated WF, of the data. And really, we look at the shape of wavefront sets, we look at the information on wavefront sets, and try to design an inverse theory around it. Now, how do we decompose our Earth medium? Well, we start with a smooth component, say a C-infinity component that seismologists will call the velocity model. Then on top of it is built a distributional component, classical Schwarz distributions, E prime for mathematicians, and that represent, say, reflectors, fault planes, pinchouts, and the like. And then we have one more refinement where we're working on actually nowadays is, well, if you even want to deduce a rougher contribution to that, suppose you have a multifractal nature detected from well logs, how can it build it in? Well, Colomb-Ball generalized functions allow you to do that. So this is kind of a hierarchy of function spaces. And what we would like to do is reconstruct as much as possible those different components of the medium. Now, what can we say about the smooth medium? Well, the smooth medium doesn't exist, of course. It's a hypothetical medium that we work with in imaging inversion. But it's a very nice medium because we can propagate waves very nicely through it by high-frequency methods. And I'll review a little bit the Maslow method, which is a key ingredient in this. Well, how do we bring in Schwarz distributions? Well, we use a single scattering approximation, Born or Kirchhoff. In fact, in anisotropic media, you're bound to do Kirchhoff due to, well, the problems you have with angles. The Born approximation is only valid for very small angles in anisotropic media, something that you do not encounter in acoustic media. So we use Kirchhoff, and really it's a single scattering approximation, so a single interaction between smooth and singular medium perturbations. And that allows you to get away with classical distribution theory. Well, if you really want to include the internal multiple scattering up to any scale, that means you want to have interactions of the singularities of the medium with the singularities in the waves, the wave front, then you cannot get away with distribution spaces anymore, and one of the ways out is to reformulate the whole story in Colomb-Ball algebras, and that is our recent work, but I won't talk about that today. And in particular, multifractals, for example, appear as Zygmund classes in Colomb-Ball algebras. Now, this is kind of the forward problem, and the idea is, well, how do we do the inverse problem? Well, in fact, if you want to do imaging inversion, we have given the smooth component, and we like to reconstruct the singular medium perturbation. And how do we do it? Well, naively speaking, we look at amplitudes on the wavefront set of the data, and we try to reconstruct from that the distribution. On the other hand, if I don't know the smooth component, how can I say something? Can I have any means of reconstructing the smooth component using the scattering theory? Well, we can prove there must exist consistencies in the wavefront set of the data. So what we do, we develop a tomography by detecting consistencies. And of course they are coupled. The one doesn't exist without the other. So there are two inverse problems that are coupled to one another. And that is pretty much, this lower part is the topic of this talk. Now an overview of the talk. Those are the subjects I will just touch upon, summarize some lemmas, some theorems. And this is roughly the processing sequence that exists today. Suppose we start with modeling in the single scattering approximation, say Born-Kirchhoff. Well, we can formulate it in terms of Fourier integral operators. And I'll discuss that actually in the most detail of everything. What is acquisition, seismic acquisition? Well, the trouble is your sources and receivers cannot be anywhere. So you have to restrict them to, say, streamer lines or actual arrays on the ocean bottom. But that restriction itself is a Fourier integral operator. And by composition, I can mimic the seismic experiment in the single scattering approximation. I call it FIO prime. Well, what is imaging? Imaging is, well, once I've discovered all the properties of that operator, I just take the adjoint of that operator over here. And that is really what people classically did in seismic imaging. But now comes the inverse problem. And the first thing you can attack is, let's look at resolution. And, well, how can I investigate resolution? Well, like in the least squares inverse problem, I look at the normal operator, meaning medium goes in, I model it, and I image it. And what comes out, I hope that I get back what I put in. And the answer is, well, in general, it doesn't. It depends on the complexity of your medium. In general, what comes out is, if you do that, a pseudo-differential operator, which is very nice because it leaves the singular support, the reflectors, in their position. But in general, you also get a non-local Fourier integral operator that moves things around. So that could be responsible for non-uniqueness in the inverse problem. And we call them, or we have called them in the past, the phantom images. Well, if you somehow or another you can deal with this non-local component separately, which in general you can't, I can invert the pseudo-differential part, the parametrics, compose it with the imaging, and I have my left inverse, which is really what we do in amplitude inversion in seismics. But if you construct it microlocally, then you can do it in the presence of, well, anisotropic elasticity and caustics. So having this, this is pretty much a review of older theory, but then we can also do something else. We can follow another path, and we can actually extend the operators over here, this modeling operator. And I'll say just a few words about it. And that extension allows us to get to a local uniqueness theorem. And then we come to the practical issues. And the final part of my talk will be about a case study of a field offshore in the North Sea. And that is, how do you actually do this? Well, in reality, in the theory, we have conic cutoffs appearing in order to be able to construct this left inverse. What are they? Seismologically speaking, I have to have conic neighborhoods of seismic dips and have to treat them separately. Mathematically, that comes out of the theory immediately that you have to do that. And that leads to the introduction of the generalized radon transform inversion. And that is really what you can compute and apply to data. That's why I put a small f here, because it's not quite a Fourier integral operator anymore. And then we'll look into consistency of the data and construct, if we have detected consistency in the data, what we call annihilators, that basically if it's consistent, I can find an operator that detects that consistency by eating up the data. And you can find an algebra of annihilators and, in a least square sense, design an optimization criterion to carry out tomography to reconstruct the smooth medium component in the end. Okay, so this is the story. What I would like to say is there's a long, long history of work that relates to this, has been at the basis of this. You can find it in an inverse problem paper that we wrote last year, a historical overview. There are close to 70 references, and it goes back actually to 1916. The first reference relating to this work is pre-Michael-Ockel analysis by Ewald. So it's by no means a completely new theory. There are many, many pieces of history, but I don't want to spend time to go through a long historical list of this. Problem definition, some notation. Let X be a scattering point in the subsurface. My surface measurements, receivers I indicate with a hat, the sources with the tilde and time t, Y prime is an acquisition manifold, and so that lies remotely on the boundary or further away of the scattering domain, and I measure in a finite time interval. Now, my restriction to, say, streamer lines induces a codimension of the acquisition manifold. I may not be able to do true 3D data acquisition. I may have like a 2.5D or something else. So that's controlled by C. That means my data are a function of 2n, n being the dimension in 3D seismology equal to 3, 2n minus 1 minus c, minus c variables. And if you count all the dimensions, I have a redundancy in the data that's overdetermined by the dimension, say 3 minus 1 minus the codimension of your acquisition. So that is a mathematical description of my data. Now, the first step is, and I'll introduce on the way some notions that are important out of microlocal analysis. I'm going to do the classical problem of wave propagation in smooth media and basically following a microlocal version of the Maslow approach. So it's classical theory, known theorems glued together to do this, but you'll see a lot of notions that will appear later on. So we have a wave equation. Elastic waves use displacement and F is body forces, so vibrators, for example. Here I've written down the elastic wave operator, split in a time part and a space part. The space part contains the stiffness tensor and the density. The leading order is an elliptic operator that's like a version of a Laplacian, but it's a generalization. Now the first step is I have three modes in dimension 3, two shear waves and one pressure wave. And I can decompose that in smooth media under certain conditions I'm not discussing here. That means, a theorem due to Taylor and Denker, I can find a matrix-valued pseudo-differential operator that I can conjugate with the wave operator so that it becomes diagonal. Okay, so the PMs are the wave operators per mode, and the modes I count by M. So those are pressure waves or shear waves, quasi-P, S1, and S2. Yeah, it's true in an anisotropic case. The only condition you have is if you have a smoothly varying medium, and look at the shear waves, that they don't have changing multiplicity in the shear wave along the bicharacteristic. And that is a problem you can address by some ideas of Ivry, but I absolutely don't want to discuss this because it would be in a day's talk to go on that technicality. But aside from that issue, yes, you can do that. So how do the mode decoupled operators look like? So they look like, again, the second order time derivative and the spatial part, where the spatial part is the diagonalized part. And now we can introduce single mode Green's functions. So Green's functions propagating a single mode, GM, associated with that wave operator. Well, this is the original Green's function. If the source, the delta source, initiates at T0 at x0 as a function of space-time, and the conjugation with that matrix value to the differential operator reappears. So this in the box is actually the transformation to go from the actual, say, displacement, the I component of displacement, to the mode M, P or S. So how do you carry this all out? How can you say something about this Green's function? Well, we're going to do that microlocally, so we're going to investigate the propagation of singularities, wavefronts, rays, bicharacteristics. So how do we do that? Well, we go to the, say, the local Fourier domain. X, xi is the wave vector, tau is frequency. And I set the determinant of the principal part of that symbol to zero, and I can solve that. Those are actually the Christoffel equations in seismology. And I can solve then the frequency in terms of the principal part of the root of the symbol of this, say, spatial part of the wave operator. And if I then work out what Q should be, well, Q should just be, they say, the columns of the Q matrix, principal part of that symbol, should be nothing else than the polarization vectors of P and S waves, so P, S1, and S2, and they should belong to the kernel of that matrix, as in the Christoffel equations classically. That is a function of space wave number, and here I have frequency that had to be equal to that due to that constraint. So it's a mathematical formulation, really, of elastic wave theory. Then I have to do one more decomposition, namely forward, backward in time. I want to propagate singularities either way. So I write my mode decoupled equation in terms of a system in time, which takes this form. And then I diagonalize it in time, and that is, of course, straightforward. All I have to introduce is now an operator B, which is the root, and here you see basically a one-dimensional hyperbolic operator appearing. And then you may wonder, well, how does this mode-decoupled Green's function relate to a forward and backward in time Green's function? Well, those Bs exactly appear as parametrices in the composition to reconstruct that. So now I've done the forward and backward in time analysis. And that allows me to understand the propagation of singularities. So now we go to the ray tracing for seismology. What is ray tracing? Well, I take the principal part of that B, that spatial part of the completely decoupled wave operator, and set up the Hamilton system to do the ray tracing. So x and psi, space and momentum, or this is space vector, slowness vector, lambda is the flow parameter along the ray, and Bm, principal part, is nothing else than your Hamiltonian for a single mode of propagation. Hamiltonian, say, for a P wave. And this is the Hamilton system written out, and the plus and the minus refers to forward or backward in time. So this is all classical. Now comes the first notion of Michael Oakley analysis, that is a canonical relation that describes tables how singularities propagate. So suppose I have initial values for my rays at x0 in the direction psi0 taking off, then my ray will propagate uniquely by solving this system, and the solution is written in mode m, so the ray coordinates xm psi m, the space and the slowness vector, parameterized by time. Time takes over the role of flow parameter here. And so what happens is the singularity initiating here in that direction will lead to singularity at xm in the direction, singular direction, psi m at the time t with frequency exactly equal to the Hamiltonian. Okay, so it's a table information of how singularities propagate. So this is basically a surface, it's a manifold, a Lagrangian manifold, that's tried by the rays, by the bi-characteristics, like you do in ray shooting in seismic computations. Well, what can we say? So we have this surface that can have kind of bumps and structures that I don't want to go into, but now we can apply a theorem due to Maslow and Fedoriuk that tells you there's a generating function associated with such a surface. And the generating function is really a general form of a travel time function. Let's call it S, M for mode, and plus for forward in time. You can prove that there are always coordinates xi, xi, j, where I, j run from 1 to 3, so mixed space and slowness vector coordinate system, x0 the initial point and tau frequency, such that all the remaining coordinates, so the dual to I and the dual to j, and the dual to frequency is time, and the dual to the initial position is the initial direction of propagation, follow from differentiation of the generating function. Okay? Well, then, the phase function, if you do a Fourier integral representation of your solution, is given by that generating function for that surface tried by the rays, Sm, plus, and then here you have two Fourier transforms, a time-frequency Fourier transform, and a wave number Fourier transform to fill out the remaining coordinates that were missing in the original choice of coordinates. And you can prove there's also always such a coordinate system. And this phase function is a non-degenerate phase function, which you need to get to the first lemma, which is really a mathematical formulation of something that ray people in seismology do all the time. Namely the following. The Green's function mode M is in fact a kernel, it's a Lagrangian distribution, it's a kernel of a Fourier integral operator with that canonical relation that I described, striped by the rays, order minus 1 1/4. It maps functions at initial points to functions somewhere in XT, and it has an oscillatory integral representation, the Fourier type, that looks as follows. Forget all those powers, I have here my phase function, okay, here my integrals over the phase variables, and then an amplitude function, which in fact is nothing else than a tensor product of a half density on the canonical relation with the Maslow-Keller line bundle. This half density is directly related to solving a transport equation, conservation of energy flux. Okay. So here we have a whole bunch of notions introduced in wave propagation that are classical. Now let us go to the next step and start introducing medium perturbation. So we go to introduce a distributional perturbation to C. So this is the background stiffness. Here's my perturbation, and also in density. And this perturbation is in E prime distribution space. And let us perturb up to first order the wave operator. So I perturb the density part and the spatial part over here. And then I can do the Born approximation, say the first order perturbation in displacement or of the Green's tensor. which is a time convolution of an incoming green stentor from the source, extelde, to the scattering point x0, and then scattered from the scattering point x0 to the receiver x hat. This indicates the time convolution over here, and within it, I have the perturbed operator, partial differential operator, that will create radiation patterns associated with the different components of the stiffness tensor that I perturb. So this is a single scattering approximation. Now, in this approximation, we can do our conjugation, a la Taylor-Denker, to do the multicoupling, and I can then substitute for the G's the oscillatory integral representations. Okay, there's a lot of work, but it's a straightforward thing, and what comes out of it is the following structure, that my Born approximated scattered field from source to receiver at time t, some vectors, an amplitude, here I have my radiation patterns sitting, and here I have my phase function. Well, it was a time convolution, that means the phase functions add up now from the source side over here, everything with tildes is now the source oscillatory integral, and everything from the receiver with hats is from the receiver side, in an inverse time Fourier transform. So, and the amplitudes multiply due to the time convolution, and the radiation patterns basically follow from all those conjugations you carry out with those, say, polarization vectors that generate some matrix values through the differential operator. So here you see all those components of that, of those polarization vectors appearing. In fact, it is a dyadic of four vectors, two polarization vectors and two slowness vectors, if you wish, the radiation patterns. And again, here I point out that the amplitude due to the time convolution in the Fourier domain is just a product. So here we come to the second lemma. That is, well, under certain other conditions, but the most important one is, let us suppose that I cannot shoot a ray all the way through. So I should have a source, I shoot a ray, and then this ray cannot really continue. That means that if we look at the vectors, the scattering vectors, they cannot align in opposite directions at the scattering point. If that is avoided, then I can design a map from the singular perturbation, the distributional perturbation, to the perturbed field, and that map is a Fourier integral operator from those two distribution spaces, and it has a canonical relation that tells you nothing else. It's written out mathematically here, that from the source to the scattering point, it should lie on the first canonical relation for one-way propagation, and the other one also, and they have to connect. That is really, if you work out the mathematics, what intuitively also comes out of it. Now, it's a very important remark. This is a very straightforward proof to do, and I'm not going to do it here. But the important thing is here I allow the sources and receivers to lie everywhere. Okay, the sources and the receivers are allowed to lie in the entire domain R3, say, in 3D seismology. Okay, so that is why this theorem is easy to prove. Here's a picture of the rays to remind you that, so here's x tilde, x hat, the cotangent vectors mathematically, those are the slowness vectors, the scattering point, and those are the initial values of the rays, and this is how the vectors add up. And this vector, in fact, exactly where this vector aligns with a singular direction of a medium, suppose you have a reflecting surface with a normal that aligns with this cotangent vector, well, then you get the singular contribution of the data. That is really what the canonical relation tells you. Okay. So now comes the hard part. I cannot put my sources and receivers everywhere, and that is where the theory becomes non-trivial. So how do we describe that? Well, we have some kind of mapping from, say, coordinates y, hypothetical coordinates y, to my actual receiver source and time. And let me partition them in a y prime and a y double prime. And let us suppose that I lose all my y double prime coordinates. For example, a streamer. I cannot have a cross streamer in the ocean. I can only have an inline streamer. That means I lose an additional dimension indicated by c. Well, what's very nice is locally, the restriction is a Fourier integral operator, not globally, only locally. And you can work out its canonical relation, which basically tells you do a forward and inverse Fourier transform and is set certain variables equal to zero. Well, when, now comes the first important step, when can I compose this restriction with my previous modeling operator and still mimic a seismic experiment, meaning still detect the wavefronts propagating in my data? Well, there's a classical microlocal analysis gives you an answer to that. The condition is if I take the product of the canonical relation of restriction and Born modeling with the cotangent bundles, here I have to be a little bit mathematical, of the subsurface of the acquisition, restricted, and this is the diagonal of the code tangent bundle associated with acquisition without restriction. If within symplectic geometry that intersection is transversal, then I can do it. I can wonder, can I compute it? Well, I can relate it to a Jacobian of a matrix, computing the rank of this matrix of variables. If that has maximal rank, then you can prove that it's nicely transversal, and you can do this. And so that leads to this theorem, perhaps the key result of my talk, that indeed, under those conditions, I can compose, I have a modeling operator, I can compose the canonical relations appropriately, mathematically written out. Well, what does the restriction mean? Well, if I have, say, a surface, the Earth's surface, I shoot my bicharacteristics, and at a certain point, those bicharacteristics will intersect the Earth's surface or the ocean bottom, and what I do is I read off the travel time that it took to hit the surface. So, in fact, the restriction y double prime equals zero gives me the travel time. So those two free parameters are gone. That is to the leading order restriction you do. That is, and then you can translate it in analysis, but that is really what is underlying all of this. So you can prove this is then nicely in FIO, you can compute the order, and you have to be careful, the density is not quite a density anymore, you can prove it's a quotient half density, but you get an anomalous factor in the density, which is a Jacobian due to the change of coordinates of y and x. So a Jacobian appears in the amplitude, which is messy. So now we come to some practical issues. Are there questions or not? Now we come to a practical issue, that is, our parametrizations are really based on surface coordinates. What we really want to do is introduce symplectic coordinates. And in dimension 3, there are very geophysical coordinates, namely what's called migration dip, scattering angle, and azimuth. Now suppose the rank of this matrix equals 2, that means maximal. That means I have really a 3D acquisition geometry on a hypersurface. Okay? Then I can prove that I can parametrize my canonical relation for scattering in terms of the scattering point, the take-off angles of the bicharacteristics, and frequency. But I can reshuffle that under certain conditions. I can also parameterize it by dip, which is the normalized sum of those vectors at the scattering point, the take-off direction, and the angle between them, and the azimuth. And this I will indicate by coordinate E, and those are actually symplectic coordinates associated with this canonical relation. This is the geophysical picture that belongs to it, and I've made a translation of mathematical to geophysical notation here to give you some ideas. So here my scattering point, my bicharacteristics, sources and receivers. So those are my original psi 0 hat and psi tilde hat. They add up and normalize them, and I get my migration dip. The angle is theta, and the azimuth is psi. Those are the symplectic coordinates. And then, well, due to the restriction, my r's and s, and I only look at the components of the cotangent vectors in the acquisition manifold. So that is the picture. Now comes assumptions we are going to make, in fact, to be able to do the tomography later on. So there are assumptions here that I didn't need for local uniqueness for the E prime component, but are conditions that I need to push it all the way through to tomography. So it's more restricted than it used to be. So let us look at the following. We have our canonical relation for scattering, Born scattering, lambda mn, say from P to S scattering is an example. And I'm going to look at the projections of that canonical relation into the subsurface cotangent bundle and acquisition cotangent bundle. Geophysical terms, the subsurface cotangent bundle gives you the information about isochrons, and the acquisition cotangent bundle gives you all the Kirchhoff diffraction surfaces. That's how you split the two, and they're connected in the canonical relation. So I'm introducing those projections. Well, if the projection into the acquisition cotangent bundle is immersive, meaning its derivative is 1-to-1, and proper, then I can proceed. But I can have a more severe condition and saying that it has to be injective. This was actually a condition investigated by Fonst and Krode, which a condition we never had to use, but for the tomography we do. And so those three conditions allow you to proceed to do the inverse scattering and to do the tomography. And one little lemma you need is, well, if that is a submersion, then in the acquisition world, then in the isochron world, it is in fact, if it's an immersion in the acquisition world, it's a submersion in the subsurface world. So the derivative is on 2. And one side product that we had a long time ago is that if I project my canonical relation of my seismic data in the single scattering approximation into the acquisition co-tension bundle, I get a coisotropic submanifold. This is a standard result of Michael Ockel analysis, nothing special. But now comes a picture, is the key picture of what we are doing. So here we have a cartoon, a canonical relation for Born scattering, say. I can project it in the subsurface or the acquisition surface, co-tension bundle. And so if this is a submersion, then that is an immersion and vice versa. And what we can prove is that the structure of the data is a coisotropic submanifold in this bundle, but it has actually more. It has a structure, a redundancy. Namely, we have an existence of what Duistermaat calls characteristic strips in this, coisotropic submanifold. That means, what it really means is, what are the coordinates of those strips? Those are going to be our scattering angle and azimuth, at least in the 3D seismic world. And it means across, if I cut it across, then I should be able, if I only integrate in my inversion across those characteristic strips, I should be able to see an image of the Earth already without doing the full inversion. Okay. So, and that is exactly what we're going to use. There's redundancy along the characteristic strips, or isotropic fibers, according to Hermander. And we're going to construct annihilators along those characteristic strips. And those annihilators annihilate data perfectly well if I have my smooth medium correctly. If it's incorrect, they don't annihilate, and then we can start to reconstruct the smooth medium. And then last but not least, we can prove that we can extend this coisotropic submanifold into the entire cotangent bundle, with coordinates epsilon, this is a symplectic coordinate construction, and we can construct an invertible Fourier-Nicol operator. Perhaps that is my only remark I want to make on a local inverse, unique inverse result that we have. So there is this extension mapping omega, and basically you can fill up the cotangent bundle and you can extend the Fourier-Nicol operator in all those coordinates and make it invertible, which is perhaps a key result. But I think the picture said it all. So let us now get to the tomography part. So now we are going to make a change. We're going to make a change from Born to Kirchhoff. What is kind of the key change you make? Well, Born scattering is sensitive to supports of distributions. Kirchhoff scattering is sensitive to the wavefront set of distributions. And that is exactly what you need. You need to know coherency of reflectors to say something about the velocity model in seismological terms. So that is why we are really doing it. How do you do it? Well, I have my perturbation of stiffness tensor, and I make it really a function of level sets. So I have interfaces, and the level sets of a particular function creates those interfaces. And mathematically, they become conormal distributions, meaning they really are singular in their derivatives across surfaces, but not in any other direction. Okay, so that is what we're mathematically doing. And then you have to adjust in all your Fourier-Nicol operators the amplitudes, B, by, well, something that is proportional to the gradient of the phase function. Now, why can I do that? I can divide by those kind of things. Well, I had to shoot. There were no rays shooting through. So the gradient, at least from the stationary point set, will never vanish. So I can freely, under those conditions, divide by this, well, symbol of an operator. And that is really what the transformation, summary of the transformation from Born to Kirchhoff is. But having done that, we come to the theorem on resolution. And this is a simple theorem due to the injectivity. It tells us the following. Suppose I do modeling and then imaging. I compose them, but I have to do a pseudo-differential cutoff. Then I end up with an elliptic pseudo-differential operator of order n minus 1. This is an old result. The proof is based on, for those of you familiar, the classical clean intersection calculus. You have to prove with the clean intersection calculus that if you compose the two, the kernel is Lagrangian, this kernel is Lagrangian, that kernel is Lagrangian again. That is what you are looking for. So, now comes the algorithmic story. How do we really do it? We come to generalized radon transforms here. So how do we do the inverse? We have the imaging and the inverse of the normal operator. That's our left inverse. Let's call that M. Well, in there, we have an integration, a measure, over the acquisition variables after restriction, dy prime. But I can give this a Stieltjes interpretation, Namely, this is in fact a function of the takeoff angles of those rays and the time, the picture. But I can also change to migration dip scattering angle and azimuth. Those are the symplectic coordinates. Okay, so I can actually consider that measure as a Stieltjes measure in that sense. Now, what do I do next? Well, I say, well, let me split the entire integral into an integral over a tiny little neighborhood of a prescribed value of this symplectic coordinates, a tiny little cone, which means it's almost a pointwise evaluation, but you can prove you cannot do that. You need a neighborhood integration. Then the remaining integration over the dip is just your generalized radon transform. And that is what we call the focusing operator. And that is the operator you can actually implement. And why is that a nice operator? That brings me to the last theorem before coming into the case study and show you the pictures how this works. Well, you can prove if you're on the stationary point set of this phase function, if I apply this particular focusing operator on data, that what comes out of it is something smooth and contracted with the singular medium, well, really the normal derivative, if you wish, the co-normal derivative of the singular medium perturbation. Say the jump in medium properties across an interface from a geological point of view. But it means for every E, this is the E, the coordinate along those characteristic strips, I get the same singular support because this is a medium. This sits there and is fixed. So for every E, I get the same image of the subsurface. That is that theorem. Well, that we can use because it means if I apply a derivative operator now in the E direction, I should get, well, not a vanishing outcome because I have this factor here, some amplitude. It's what we call AVA analysis in seismology. I have to remove this AVA effect. But apart from that, it should vanish. So that is what we're going to do with an annihilator. But there's one subtle problem here. In our amplitudes of our Fourier integral operators, we have introduced half densities on the canonical relations, and they are a function of the background medium properties, the smooth medium properties. So I'm actually making use of the current guess of the smooth medium in my evaluation. Can I remove that? Well, the answer is certainly you can. There exists a polar decomposition of this operator. So my modeling operator can be split in a unitary operator and an elliptic pseudo-differential operator that has the same canonical relation as the original modeling operator. And mathematically, why can you do that? Well, this is our modeling in inverse, which is the identity. Well, I can factor this because it's an elliptic pseudo-differential operator into two reciprocal half powers, and then I get just an adjoint inverse relationship. So that is how I construct my unitary operator. And what have I done in practical terms? I've removed my sensitivity to geometrical spreading. So there's a geophysical reason to do this. And then what is finally my annihilator? It's basically building it up from differentiations along the characteristic strips, but I have to take care of this AVA effect, and I have to take care of removing the geometrical spreading. But effectively, it's just a derivative along the characteristic strips. And how do we do our tomography? Well, we apply this annihilator to the focusing operator composed with this polar decomposition for a current velocity model, and we try to minimize this functional. And we integrate over all scattering points and along those characteristic strips that I showed in this wavefront set of the data. Now, mathematically, how can you continue? How can you do this? Well, what you do, and I really would like to go to the example, but I will be happy to show you some papers on what we have done. How can you compute an optimization scheme to do this? How can you get a local result in solving this inverse problem? Well, like in any optimization scheme, I need the gradient of this functional. But how does the gradient appear? Well, I have to take the gradient of this operator. What is that gradient? Well, I have to choose a curve in medium space, and then I have to differentiate along that curve, and what I'm doing, I'm actually constructing the tangent space to the space of Fourier integral operators. And in fact, you can prove that, that is a recent theorem that I don't want to discuss here, that this tangent space is in fact generated by an algebra of pseudo-differential operators of order 1. And this algebra structure you use to not only compute the gradient, but compute the adjoints to do the optimization in the Fourier gradient technique. Okay, so there's a beautiful geometry behind the space of Fourier integral operators to do this. But I don't want to go into those details here. I'm happy to discuss it. So that brings me to do a case study, show you some pictures. How does this actually work? Now, First, we started with a very small toy model. Let me show you the seismic data. So this is a two-dimensional model in this case. And here, in fact, you see the receiver for a fixed source, and here you see time. And those are, this is a finite difference simulation. This is just of an extremely simple model, you may believe it or not, a finite difference simulation of elastic waves. In fact, this is isotropic. I'll show you an hexagonal case later on. And the question is, what's going on here? How do I start? How do I image? How do I invert? How do we do velocity analysis? So how do I reconstruct the distributional component and the smooth components here? And let me show you, this is the vertical component, which highlights the PP, the fastest spike characteristics. But I can also plot the horizontal component, which highlights the next fastest spike characteristics, namely mode-converted waves. So M and N, in this case, are not equal, and they're hidden over here. So can anybody guess what the model is in this case? And unless you've seen it before, I guess you won't recognize it. Well, it's in fact just a gas cloud model. This is what it is. For P and S velocities in this case, I have a compacting sequence, a horizontal, in fact, mimicking a reservoir, a fault plane, and gas that escaped from the reservoir. And this is a Gaussian symmetric gas lens, so it's a low velocity zone. In the P wave velocity, a minor effect on the shear wave velocity. That is what's happening. So what happens? Well, I just form, in fact, only two caustics here, nothing else. And this is just one of the ray fans you can compute by wavefront construction. So this is a highlight, the lens. Here have a caustic, and I have a second caustic here due to the fault plane reflection. And now I go to construct along those characteristic strips the focusing operator. Okay, what you see here, and let us first look into this bottom picture. Here you see the coordinate E. Well, in two dimensions, I only have scattering angle. Okay? So there's only one coordinate. And here you see at one particular offset x0, so one particular coordinate in the horizontal, I plot the vertical coordinate. So this is depth, and for one particular frozen horizontal coordinate. And in fact, it is the one precisely hitting through the gas cloud. Over here. So it's the one hitting straight through here. That is the line you see. And again, horizontally, you see this symplectic coordinate E. So we have unfolded the caustic perfectly. Now, what do you see here? You see here different conic neighborhoods. Remember, I had this psi, this conic cutoff, which means I have always to do the integration over local conic neighborhoods of the dip. Well, this is, I showed you a few conic neighborhoods. This is the conic neighborhood that clearly is not in focus, because I only see artifacts. Here's the conic neighborhood that's also not in focus. And here, I suddenly have a conic neighborhood that is in focus. And in fact, the computer code finds it itself. I just illustrate it here. And here you see my reflector coming back. And if I integrate with the proper weights, then I do my inverse, by the way. And suppose I would not have done conic neighborhoods. That's always interesting. I get a lot of garbage around here. Well, in fact, the reason is, if you don't do this, you really don't have globally an invertible Fourier integral operator if I throw out the symplectic coordinates E. And that is why you get those artifacts. But if I do the inverse, then I can do a perfect reconstruction of this reservoir and fault plane. Okay, so the end result is shown over here, where I make use of the proper conic neighborhoods to do that. Now, that is maybe, for us at least, not so surprising that we can do this anymore. We did this a long time ago. But now the objective was, suppose I didn't know there was a lens, and the only thing I know is that I have a compacting sequence. Suppose I have a remote well, and I know basically a gradient with depth of the medium, but I don't know any lateral medium variations. And now I go through my annihilator approach. And here you see five iterations, and I've highlighted that same symplectic coordinate at that particular section through the gas cloud. And of course, if I don't put in the lens, then I get the caustic, in fact, in that focusing operator, because I've made a severe mistake. Well, if you highlight it, you see beautifully a caustic appearing. And here you see the gradient plotted in the model. There's two legs, actually multiple legs, to the sources and to the receivers. And then we start to apply the annihilator and use this algebra of tangent spaces, and you see that it starts to become flat. Well, I have all those effects, but basically it's a derivative in this direction that you try to minimize. And as you see, in five iterations, you're pretty close. And does that really happen? And the answer is it certainly does. This is the inverse. This is the upper part of the model only. And this was the original. And this is only after five iterations. Of course, we could continue. And you can get very close to the true gasoline. So we're able to reconstruct smooth medium variations also by using microlocal methods. Now, if I may end with a real data, a few pictures of real data case study. In fact, this all started, we did the initial imaging inversion theory in the early 90s, but then we picked it up when BP came with the following problem, the Valhall field offshore North Sea. They have close to 200 wells in this reservoir, so they know pretty well where the reservoir is, but you cannot see it. Where's the reservoir here? This is a conventional Kirchhoff-Priestek depth migration. The reservoir is just below 2,500 meters. So if you see, if you highlight this, there's not even a single wiggle in this picture, and they could not see the reservoir at all. And the question was, well, with those microlocal techniques, taking into account caustics and anisotropy, the whole lot, can you resolve this? Well, the trouble is what they suspected, and they were right, is there's a reservoir here, it has a gas cap, and the shale overlying it is fractured and gas has escaped. And unfortunately, that hasn't done it in a very nice way. It has formed kind of a stack of lenses. And that is why the data looks so bad. And the question is, where did the data really go? So remember this picture. Then we can go through this whole scheme, building the C infinity model that looks like this. In fact, this will be published in the Leading Edge, this story, very soon it will appear. So here you see that highlighted section, and here you see all the lenses that came out of the analysis. Those are low-velocity gas lenses. So the Gaussian gas lens was just a toy model to play with, but this is the reality. So it's much worse. We have between this point and to some of those service points in the order of 17 caustics appearing. And the reservoir is right here. And then the question is, now I start to create those characteristic strip panels with the proper conic neighborhoods. If you look at PP waves, well, for those of you that have not seen seismic data, this may not look very good. For those of you who have seen the Valhall data, they will fall off their chairs. And what you see here is, so this is one of the symplectic coordinates. This is depth right at the reservoir. And here you see this pack of reflectors you see over here is exactly the reservoir level. And this is when you do the conic cutoff, and this is when you don't. And as you see, your data become much more noisy. And what is even nicer, if you go for the quasi-P, quasi-SV conversion, then you get quite a spectacular result. This is with the conic cutoff. And here you see this reflector coming up, but you see here sign change. In fact, that was because we didn't have the perfect anisotropic parameters yet. And they use that now as a fluid indicator, in fact. So if you sign change it here, you get a perfect alignment. And this is if you wouldn't do the conic cutoff. And as you see, obviously, I mean, mathematically you know it's incorrect, but in data processing that is convincing also. And then we can do our inverse, and I like to bring up the... I'm really skipping a lot of steps here, obviously. Then I can do the vertical P and vertical SV impedance image of that little white box. Actually, let me show that white box again. I've enlarged this white box. And look at the detail that is in here. Basically, the entire reservoir shows up. In the PS image, you see it over here. You even can draw fault planes in here. And in the PP image, you get, of course, due to the wavelength, the higher resolution. So again, you see the fault structures coming up, and the reservoir is right here. So it was invisible. It's visible now. And that is pretty much the moral of the story. So it's a nice mix of where analysis and seismology come together in a success story. Thank you for your attention.
First, Mark, you can start a little bit late with my skill at the beginning, but I think we have time for a couple of questions.
Okay. Yes.
Is your normal operator, is your differential operator, does the differential operator is always true, or...?
No. No. So, in fact, I had those conditions. If I plot this picture of Lambda MN in T star, say, the subsurface and in the acquisition world, then the key is, if you investigate this projection, it has to be an immersion, and it almost always is. Oops, this is kind of funny chalk. And it has to be proper. But if it's not injective, in fact, I can get all kind of interesting patterns. Do you have a minute to draw some pictures? For example, if the injectivity condition fails, and then you get a non-local free integral operator, you can get, I mean, let me see if I can remember this. Suppose I have a ray like this, then I think I have a ray like that. And then if the travel time through those loops is equal, for example, I can have, say, a reflection can go in here and then skip, if it was the initial one, to that one. Actually, I may have a view graph of this. I can have a reflecting surface here. Then I can, and I come out, say, here and here. And then I can go back the non-reciprocal ray, and it could have a different reflector dip. And the travel times and all the geometrical quantities are the same. That means that, in principle, in my normal operator, I get a non-local contribution in terms of the cotangent vectors. And so, in fact, that gives you non-uniqueness at this reconstruction. And it happens, now I have to be a little bit more cautious, it happens exactly if it happens just in an isolated point. If that is locally the case, it doesn't matter, because it gives you a contribution of measure zero. But if I perturb the medium a little bit, so that it can happen more often, then this is a problem, and it's not true what I'm saying, and the injectivity condition reduces that. In fact, in this case, you can still prove that this intersection condition, the clean intersection condition, is true with x is zero, in fact, in this case. But you get operators that can be as singular as the true reflector part, and hence you have a non-uniqueness in that case. Now, there's a whole story around this, because, in fact, this happens if you have a waveguide. So if you have, say, a soldome, and you, say, a pinch out like this, and this is a low-velocity zone, you can shoot rays into this waveguide. That is typically where those things happen. And we have put an effort, but I didn't want to discuss it today, into understanding those kind of contributions. In fact, some of that is discussed in... There's a list of references in the abstract. You can see that. And what you then try to do is estimate the Sobolev orders of the non-local operators. And if the Sobolev order is one less, you can use wavelet techniques to estimate the artifact in your image. It's a very long story, but that is roughly what you would do. But the simple answer is, by putting an injectivity here, artificially, I've removed this issue and simplified my talk. That's kind of what I did. Okay.
Care for a 3-minute break? Or-